So as has been said, I'm going to do a shortish reading from this book, and then I'll go into my main topic of discussion, which revolves around revelry and how I see that, and again this is a personal view, how I see that might fit into concepts like the Eightfold Path, and how, you know, is there such a thing as right revelry. So the reading is from What Makes You Not a Buddhist by, I'm going to have a go at pronouncing this, Zongsa Yangyung Khinsi Rinpoche, and it's called Baby Rattles and Other Distractions. In our everyday lives, we have this impulse to shield ourselves and others from the truth. We've become impervious to obvious signs of decay. We encourage others by not dwelling on it and by employing positive affirmations. We celebrate our birthdays by blowing out candles, ignoring the fact that the extinguished candles could equally be seen as a reminder that we are a year closer to death. We celebrate the new year with firecrackers and champagne, distracting ourselves from the fact that the old year will never come back again, and the new year is filled with uncertainty and anything can happen. When that anything is displeasing, we deliberately divert our attention, like a mother distracting a child with rattles and toys. If we feel down, we might go shopping. We might treat ourselves. We go to the cinema. We build fantasies and aim for lifetime achievements, beach houses, plaques and trophies, maybe early retirement, nice cars, good friends and family, fame, and even making it into the Guinness Book of World Records. Later in life, we want a devoted companion with whom we can take on a cruise or raise purebred poodles. Magazines and televisions introduce and reinforce such models of happiness and success, ever inventing new illusions to trap us. These notions of success are our grown-up baby rattles. Hardly anything we do in the course of the day, neither in our thoughts nor our actions, indicates that we are aware of how fragile life is. We spend our time doing things like waiting at the multiplex for a bad movie to start, or rushing home to watch reality TV. As we sit watching commercials, waiting, our time in this life ebbs away. So on that downer, I will now turn to the, before you put the, this, my little talk, a reflection, if you will, on revelry and the Eightfold Path, or is there such a thing as right revelry? So what I'd like to do is set this up a little bit by just thinking about the act of revelry itself. Like, we all have engaged in some form of revelry at some point in our lives, hopefully. And everybody has a different idea of what revelry is. To some, and this is probably in extremis, it's a day or possibly weekend of intoxicated debauchery, maybe even tied to some specific celebratory date or event. Maybe for some it happens every weekend. To others, an act of revelry may involve, say, fervent dancing, involving possibly amusing or colourful costumes. And yet to others, it may be simply immersing themselves wholeheartedly in some favourite pastime or pursuit. So like many other things in life, I don't think there's a one-size-all-fits revelry. It's very much different strokes for different folks. Also, to put this in some sort of historical or mythological context, it might pay to just for me to quickly think about where one form of revelry may have come from. So I actually took a look at our old favourite Wikipedia and was looking up concepts of revelry. And what I dug out was what I consider to probably be the grand master of revelry. No, it wasn't Oliver Reed or Richard Harris, both of whom are famous actors, and actually both appeared in the film Gladiator, if anybody's ever seen that. In actual fact, I believe Oliver Reed actually died in the making of Gladiator, although it wasn't on camera, but he died. And actually, I believe it was in some either result of revelry or some act of revelry that happened there. Actually, I think Richard Harris didn't die in the... Well, he was killed in the film, actually, in the film itself, although he didn't die for real. The person I'm thinking of is Dionysus, who's the god of the grape harvest. Winemaking and wine, ritual madness, fertility, theatre, and religious ecstasy in Greek mythology. And obviously alcohol, it's especially wine, played an important role in Greek culture. And with Dionysus, this being an important reason for this lifestyle. He may have been worshipped very early on, around 1500 to 1100 BC, by Mycenaean Greeks. And there's traces of his cults in things like ancient Minoan Crete. So, to a certain degree, the origins are uncertain. His cults took many different forms. In some, he arrives from the east as an Asiatic foreigner. In others, from Ethiopia. From the south, he's the god of Epiphany. He's the god that comes. And his foreignness is almost implied as this sort of arriving outsider god, which seems to be inherent in the cults. But he's a major popular figure in Greek mythology. In terms of images of this reveller, he's often shown as a mature male, bearded and robed, holds this fennel staff, which is tipped with this sort of pine cone. Later images show him as a beardless, sensuous, naked or half-naked androgynous youth. And in that literature it describes him as womanly or man-womanish. But a lot of these images show him as some sort of triumphant return, which is normally disorderly, like he's arriving out of some exotic place that he's come back from, almost as if it's from the borders of the known civilised world. And so he sort of symbolises everything that's chaotic, dangerous and unexpected, everything that escapes human reason, and only can be attributed to the unforeseeable actions of the god. Also, he's known as Bacchus, a name adopted by the Romans, and the frenzy he induces, Bacchia. And in this case, his wand often has ivy and just dripping with honey for some reason. And it's a beneficent wand, but also a weapon, apparently. And it could be used to destroy those who oppose his cult and the freedoms he represents. And so his name sort of crops up in different forms. Also, there's a sort of cult of the souls, and his minions feed the dead through his blood offerings. So it sounds like he's a pretty much an all-round party animal, as things go. So me, that's what I associate sort of revelry with, or historically, that's where I think it came from. Other people may have a different understanding, but that's sort of where I'm coming from on this position. So we've got revelry, then we have the Eightfold Path. Now, I'm not going to go through the Eightfold Path in any great detail, because that would take weeks of ins and outs. Well, it takes a whole lifetime, obviously, to explore. And I just make the point, just so we're clear, I don't self-identify as a Buddhist. And when I think about it, it would be rather difficult for me, as I wouldn't actually have any self to identify. It was this question of no self in Buddhism. But I do find Buddhist practice has many useful tools when thinking about the possible consequences of one's actions. And in fact, over the past 30 years, I've spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, the consequences of actions through a Buddhist or Taoist perspective. So central to the practice of Buddhism is this concept of the Four Noble Truths, and how from these Four Noble Truths you emerge with the Eightfold Path. And so, just to clarify, the Four Noble Truths are the truth of suffering, the truth of the cause of suffering, the truth of freedom from suffering, and the truth of the way to eliminate suffering, which is the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path comprises of right understanding, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, they're not necessarily in that particular order, but they are grouped together, and some things do feed in onto the others, but there's like this recursive circular relationship going on, and stuff feeding into different things. But the point is that there is this path, there is this way that you can look at life and try and work your way through it. One thing I will point out, and I know for a lot of people the term right is rather a loaded word, and I know in discussions I used to have with my Buddhist meditation teacher about the translation of the word right. She always said that one way to look at it, and not to present that sort of dogmatic and commanding ideal you get with the word right, is to maybe substitute the word appropriate, basically. So there is, rather than right action, you have appropriate action, or rather than right understanding, you have appropriate understanding. Also, I've heard terms like skillful used, and wholesome or ideal. So it's just a different word that maybe makes you think about in non-dogmatic ways. So the point here is, can revelry ever be appropriate? Well, again, it depends on the degree of revelry. Certainly a period of intoxicated debauchery would be difficult to imagine without some associated suffering of some kind. While it is interesting, and what thing I think find interesting about this, and it sort of goes back to this idea of baby rattles, is the revelry of this sort of type could be actually being used by the reveller as a distraction from suffering. So they're introducing suffering in order to take their mind off some other form of suffering that might be going on. And this could be a case of, I think, what they call in Buddhism being shot twice by the same archer. Or more than twice if you're doing it on consecutive weekends. There's a great quote, actually, which I've added in here, which I just was reminded of this morning, earlier, which is, pain is inevitable in life. Suffering itself is optional. I can't remember where that came from, but I know it's a Buddhist quote. Taking it down a notch and moving down to that sort of costume-enhanced dancing that I mentioned earlier on, if both the costume and the dancing were appropriate to the occasion, then one could probably find little problem with that. And again, there's a good deal of ritual reverie, which often goes down that route. However, in order to engage in that sort of revelry, it does imply some degree of loss of control. And it is difficult for me to envisage a situation where one has simultaneously, I need to rewrite this, one has simultaneously both skillfulness and loss of control. So there's this sort of, you know, is it one thing or the other? But that being said, if there was no suffering to oneself, or there wasn't some sort of trip and fall incident, you can tell I work for a law firm, then it would be difficult to see any problem with that. And finally, this sort of revealing or reveling in a pastime. This is something I'm known to do, absorb myself in my pastimes. Are you absorbing the pastime, or is the pastime absorbing you? When you do this, are you being mindful, or are you being mindless? Is your focus one-pointed or many-pointed? And the thing is, only you can truly know with that sort of self-absorption. Because in this instance, you are the reveller, you're the action, and all actions have consequences. And again, as I've thought about this, because I've been reflecting on my reflection, I was watching a talk on YouTube where it was several years old, and I think it was Brian McGee, who's a famous philosophical writer, was interviewing another esteemed philosopher, and they were talking about Husserl and Heidegger and Sartre, and they made the point that from their point of view, people don't really act, they're just coping. Basically, in life, we go through life thinking we're acting, but a lot of the time, we're acting on something, But actually what we're really doing is sort of coping with what life turns up on us. And something is also acting on us. And when we engage in revelry in any when I engage in revelry of any type, I might ask myself such questions as, where does this fit in with my worldview? What's my intention in all of this? What am I actually communicating in my act of revelry? How am I conducting myself in revelry? How does this fit in with my daily routines? Is this revelry useful to me in some way? Is it causing me to be inattentive? Where's my focus? So there's all these things that sort of come up as a result of appropriate mindfulness, appropriate concentration that you might think about with revelry. Another way of approaching this, and often I do this with problematic paradigms, is to think about, in this case, revelry as a process. Okay, so supposing I took my reveling state from something which wasn't skillful and appropriate, and I tried to apply it to something else that would result in more a skillful, appropriate outcome. Say, in reveling in a task that needs to be done. So, for instance, housework plus revelry. Is that now appropriate? Or important paperwork and revelry. And I could go on, you can see where I'm going with this. So basically taking this idea, which may be inappropriate in some instances, and applying it somewhere else where it has appropriateness. The useful thing when you think about this is, as a process, as a transformational process, it can be applied to so many different objects of attention. And as I further as I further complicated these different degrees of revelry, it did start to cross my mind that there may be like a revelry sweet spot. Okay, so you take yourself to the very edge of skillfulness zone, and just as you're about to sort of go over the edge into loss of control, you sort of nudge it back. So you're sort of in this revelry sweet spot where it's not quite there, but it's just nice. You're sort of in the zone of appropriate revelry. And then, again, as I thought about this more, something that sprang out as I contemplated everything that I considered and is important, that in my revelry, whatever form that might take, although I might not actually be saying anything, I was still sending out a message. I was like, you know, in Buddhism you have this image of taking a stone and plopping it into a still water, and you get these waves out. So I suppose what I'm saying is, yes, there is appropriate revelry, but just be mindful of the consequences. And so just finishing up with this, to finish off the whole sort of idea of revelry and consequences and responsibility. I've got a quote here from, it might be lost on a lot of people. This is a popular culture quote. There was a band in the 80s. They would be considered to be an anarcho-punk band, I suppose, of the 80s, called Crass. And they had this album called Yes Sir I Will. And there's this brilliant line at the very end of the album, the last line in the album, which goes, "You must learn to live with your own consequences, your own morality, your own decision, your own self. You alone can do it. There is no authority but yourself."